You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
We can see that illuminated sign that marks the end of the journey.
This vaccine will help us to get past this pandemic once and for all.
We need people to have faith that this vaccine is safe and that they should take it. The thing that's going to stop us from seeing the end of this pandemic are people going, oh, I'm not so sure.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Sebastian Salek.
Yeah, and a very good afternoon. I'm Roger Hearing. Today is truly a historic day, with the Trump era ending and Joe Biden being sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. It's a moment that sets up some challenges for a country like Britain, which has historically, of course, very strong transatlantic links. Boris Johnson had pretty close ties to Donald Trump, which, along with his Brexit policy, might set him at odds with the incoming administration.
Yeah, and earlier we spoke to Tom Tugendhat, the Conservative MP for Tonbridge and Malling and Chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, about Biden's Irish ancestry and what it means for the special relationship.
When the President-elect Biden was making his comments, Britain was making various different suggestions about breaking international law, and the government backed down almost instantly. So it's worth noting that this administration is clearly listening to what Biden is saying. And it's also worth pointing out that many people keep talking about soon-to-be President Biden's pro-Irish basis as though this was anti-British. President Biden, when he was a senator, was one of the few senators to back the United Kingdom in the war against Argentina in the Falkland Islands. And the peace process that he helped build in Northern Ireland saved the lives of British citizens and the UK citizens in Northern Ireland, in Manchester, in London, in Deal, and many other places. This is a very important part of our common relationship. And so somebody who is pro-Irish is by definition pro-peace on these islands and pro the United Kingdom.
Tom Tugendhat there. Well, Biden made it clear the Good Friday Agreement is of crucial importance to him, and his annoyance was evident, as we heard there, when the UK government suggested international law might be broken in the Brexit negotiations in a way that could, for example, mean a hard border between Belfast and Dublin. Let's bring in Northern Ireland's First Minister, Arlene Foster, who joins us now. Arlene Foster, welcome to the programme, and thank you so much for being with us. Let me ask you that simple question first. Are you pleased that the new president takes a very strong interest in Ireland?
Well, I think there's a lot of Americans take a very strong interest in Northern Ireland and in matters right across the island. I have met with the incoming president when he was a vice president. And as you know, there is almost a pilgrimage to the United States of America in March every year around St. Patrick's Day. And as the first minister back in 2016, I was over and I had a very pleasant engagement with the then Vice President, and I look forward to continuing the relationship for the benefit of Northern Ireland and indeed for the benefit of everybody so that we can continue to have our open trade that we have with the United States.
And First Minister, it sounds like he may be making a reciprocal visit. Newry, Mourne and Down Council members inviting Mr. Biden to South Down to trace his Irish roots. Some DUP council members, though, are opposing this, accusing him of bigotry over his attitude to the Orange Order. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think he made some very unfortunate comments to the then Taoiseach when he was greeting him, I think, the year before, in 2015, I think it was, when he said, there's no orange here, which was a very unfortunate thing to say, because, of course, at the very heart of the Belfast Agreement is an understanding that it is a balanced agreement between unionism and nationalism, and that it is a matter for those of us who live here in Northern Ireland to decide on our future. So it was an unfortunate issue and one that I hope he has reflected on. He certainly didn't indicate that to me when I had the conversation with him in 2016.
Would you welcome his becoming involved in further discussions about the nature of the border, for example, in the future?
Well, I think the border issue has been well settled. Of course, there is a border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. We're two separate jurisdictions. We have two separate currencies. We're in the UK customs area. The Republic of Ireland stays in the European Union. So there are differences, of course, but I think at the heart of the Belfast Agreement, it is around the relationships, not just between Northern Ireland and the Republic, but also between the two islands, actually, east-west as well, is as important as north-south. And I think that has been the huge disappointment for us in Northern Ireland, that because of the protocol which has been instituted, there has been damage to east-west, and therefore that needs to be addressed. And we're working to try and address those issues at present.
And is there a role then for Joe Biden in addressing these issues and the others that have been brought about as a result of Brexit?
Well, I think there needs to be a better understanding of what the Belfast Agreement is about, because if you listen to some people, you think it's just about north-south, right? Actually, it's about much more than that. If you look at the Belfast Agreement, it has three parts to it. It has the internal piece for Northern Ireland, obviously the devolved institution here. It then has the north-south relationship between Dublin and Belfast. But then, very importantly as well, it has the British Isles part to it, so that you have that east-west relationship reflected as well. So if you're talking about the Belfast Agreement, you have to talk about the totality of the Belfast Agreement and not just parts of it. So I hope when if I do get another opportunity to engage with the President, that I can bring a better understanding of the Belfast Agreement to him and indeed to many others in the United States of America.
Well, I guess the word Brexit will inevitably fall into that conversation, just because so obviously what Brexit has done is made quite a few changes, not least the empty shells many people have been reporting, the establishment in effect of a kind of border down the Irish Sea, which at one point the DUP were very much pushing against. There is a different customs arrangement there. Can all this be resolved? I mean, are you going to sort out what's going on in terms of the shipment of goods into Northern Ireland so that shoppers are not deprived of what they're used to?
Well, of course, this all could have been avoided if the protocol hadn't been put in place. Those of us who voted to leave the European Union wanted to leave on the same basis as the rest of the United Kingdom. However, the Prime Minister, in putting forward the protocol, accepted a flawed reasoning that somehow the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland was more important than the border between the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland. So therefore, we are now having to deal with the protocol and all that entails, having to deal with goods that are at risk of going into the single market via Northern Ireland, having to deal with the fact that there are issues that are causing delays in goods coming over to Northern Ireland. As you can imagine, that's taking up quite a bit of my time at the moment in dealing with some of those difficulties. We have resolved some of them. For example, the issue on VAT on second-hand cars has been largely resolved. We have still issues around tariffs on steel, which we hope will be resolved today. There's a whole multitude of issues that need to be dealt with, but of course, we warned of all of these issues before the protocol was put in place, but regrettably, the Prime Minister called the general election. He got an 80-member majority, and that allowed him to put through the protocol, and I very much regret that that was the case, but we have to deal with what's in front of us now.
Looking back now, First Minister, with everything we know and the way that Brexit has played out, do you regret not backing Theresa May's deal, which would have avoided a lot of this?
No, it wouldn't, of course, and that's the fallacy that a lot of people like to put out there. Under Theresa May's deal, of course, we would have remained within the EU customs code and the single market for goods forever, and you will recall very famously Geoffrey Cox, when he was the Attorney General, said that there was no way out of the EU customs system and the single market under Theresa May's backstop deal, which was actually a front stop. We were going to be in it, and we were going to be in it forever, at least under the protocol, and I don't like it, and we voted against it. we have the opportunity to vote on whether we stay in the single market for goods in 4 years' time. The Assembly has the opportunity to have that vote, so we can deal with that issue then. And hopefully we will be able to leave like the rest of the United Kingdom at that point in time. But under Theresa May's deal, there was no opportunity to do that.
First Minister, we had the SDLP leader, Colm Eastwood, on our programme last week. He said the new arrangements post-Brexit link Belfast more closely to Dublin strengthens the case for a united Ireland. I mean, you may not want it, but that seems to be clearly the case, doesn't it?
No, it's not the case at all. I mean, of course, Colm's going to make that point. He is an Irish nationalist. He wants to see an all-Ireland state, despite the fact that we are moving into the centenary of Northern Ireland this year. And there are many, many reasons why we should remain part of the United Kingdom, not just because of what the UK does for us here in Northern Ireland, but actually what Northern Ireland brings to the table in terms of the United Kingdom. Obviously, historically, the amount of people who serve in our armed forces from Northern Ireland is of a higher ratio than anywhere else in the UK. And of course, today we are leaders in cybersecurity, in fintech, in artificial intelligence and advanced engineering. And just recently, Queen's University in Belfast overtook Cambridge as the university ranked most highly for entrepreneurial impact. So we have so much to be proud of being part of the United Kingdom. And I have to say, in terms of the way in which we are rolling out the vaccination programme in Northern Ireland is just one of the things that I'm proud of, because we are number one in the United Kingdom in terms of rolling out the vaccination programme. And of course, as part of the UK, we have access to all of that, and we're very pleased to be able to do that.
I've got to ask you about that. I mean, 7% of the population is done, I believe, outperforming the south of Ireland as well. What's the secret there, and when do you see the whole of the Northern Irish population being vaccinated?
Well, of course, because we're part of the UK, we have access to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccination, which in the Republic they do not, because they're waiting on that being approved by the European Health Authorities. So we have been able to roll it out in a very meaningful way in our care homes first with the Pfizer vaccine, and now through our GP system and through our vaccination centre systems right across Northern Ireland. So very pleased in the way in which that's rolling out.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Let's have a look at what else is making the news in the world of politics. And Roger, we start with quite the intervention from Theresa May.
Yes, there is something of a tradition in British politics of former prime ministers not being terribly kind towards their successors, but this, it has to be said, is at a whole new level. The former prime minister Theresa May has accused Boris Johnson of abandoning the UK's moral leadership on the world stage. Theresa May said the prime minister's decision to cut the overseas aid budget below 0.7% of national income had reduced the UK's global credibility. She told the Daily Mail the UK had to live up to its values and said it would be judged by its actions, not its rhetoric.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can say when you're on the back benches. And then some more fantastic government tech wizardry for you. There's criticism that out-of-date computer systems are causing people to miss out on virus support. So the chair of the Public Accounts Committee, Meg Hillier, is now calling on HMRC to explain why some taxpayers have not received furlough payments.
IT and old-style legacy IT systems are things we've been raising for some time, so we're not going to go soft on them on that. And I think they would acknowledge, too, that COVID cannot be excuse for everything.
Meg Hillier. Well, meanwhile, the Bank of England's chief economist says the government can afford to end its furlough plan before the UK's recovery is fully complete. Andy Haldane told Bloomberg the economy may be growing quickly enough by the second quarter to absorb the 1 million people who lost their jobs as a result of the virus crisis.
Bit of good news there, a nice economic forecast when things are looking pretty bad right now, that the second quarter could start to brighten up a bit. And then we've got to talk about Brexit. A key UK government system has been overwhelmed, threatening to trigger more disruption at the border. So exporters say that they're struggling to acquire transit documents, which allow goods to enter the EU without delay because of a shortage of agents with the authority to issue them. Firms wanting to apply for a transit guarantee or increase the size of their existing one have also struggled because of delays at HMRC. So just a little update there on how things are going. And we will talk about that with Therese Raphael in just a minute.
Meanwhile, Boris Johnson's held off another Tory rebellion. The House of Commons narrowly voted down an amendment to a law on international trade agreements, which could allow victims to ask courts to rule on claims of genocide against potential trading partners like China. That ruling would have forced the government to consider pulling out of deals with the state involved. China has repeatedly described claims of human rights abuses as baseless.
Yes, a big China week in Parliament today, another big bill being discussed that has implications on that relationship. But let's get back to the US, a big day in Washington, where Joe Biden is sworn in as the 46th president of the United States. Joining us now to talk about this is Bloomberg opinion columnist Therese Raphael. Therese, let's look at this from the UK angle. Boris Johnson, let's face it, was pretty close to Donald Trump. How hard is it going to be for him now to woo Joe Biden, given that history?
Well, I find myself in agreement with your earlier guest, the MP Tom Tugendhat, who made the point that these are professional politicians who are going to act in their national interests, which is very much in favor of cooperation. They have a lot in common on environmental policy, on China, not least, on generally restoring a sense of kind of internationalism and transatlantic cooperation. So I don't think we're going to see Biden rushing to do Boris Johnson any favors, for example, expediting a trade deal. I think that's that's something partly because he just has so much on his plate right now with the pandemic, the economic costs that are that he'll have to deal with, and also just the sheer divisions in American society as a result of recent years. So I think that it's a relationship that will be professional. It will be close. It may not be full of the kind of favors that you might expect with two leaders who have a long history together.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things in this is China, because Tom Tugendhat, who we spoke to earlier, actually said he thought it was one issue, China, that the US and the UK could come together over. But in fact, if you look at it, obviously there was that vote in the Commons last night which narrowly stopped being able to force the courts to declare China guilty of genocide. At the same time, Mike Pompeo, outgoing Secretary of State, has said China's guilty of genocide, and indeed the Secretary of State of Joe Biden, Antony Blinken, has called on all relevant judicial bodies to hold Beijing to account. So it doesn't look like they're moving in the same direction.
Well, it may be more of a matter of degrees, but it's clear that the U.S. will set the tone on China policy, and the question is how far Boris Johnson will be willing to go to kind of to match it. The vote last night was interesting because in one sense it was over a kind of technical issue. It wasn't over the question of whether declare the actions against the Uyghurs as a genocide, but whether that is the purview of the courts or whether Parliament should retain that role. But the fact that we have 33 Tory MPs voting against the government just shows the depth of feeling there is here. And I think there'd be a lot of support for sticking closely with the U.S. on that. We've also seen U.S. policy move the U.K. on Huawei, for example. There will be new legislation being introduced on investment into the U.K. that will probably further align it with the U.S. So, I don't see differences in principle so much as the policy choices in responding to the Chinese threat. But the clearly this is an area where it's in the interest of the U.S. to build alliances rather than the sort of Trump approach, which is just to kind of respond unilaterally. And the U.K. Would be a key ally here. So, I think we'll. The G7 meeting will give us an indication of kind of what tools they will use, but I would expect to see a lot more cooperation there.
So 30-odd rebels then last night, not enough to pass the amendment. But certainly in an age of research groups and various caucuses within the Tory party, the China research group is proving to be one of the more prominent ones. How big an issue is that going to be for Boris Johnson down the line? This China issue is not going to go away, and these people are still going to keep on beating their drum.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about the 33 rebels, it was a combination of, you know, those who are very focused on human rights issues and China hawks, you know, who've focused on other aspects of, you know, of China's threat, say, on security issues and investment. And, you know, it is a powerful coalition. And I think what it shows is that Boris Johnson can have an 80-seat majority in Parliament, but 80 isn't what it used to be, because there are all sorts of ways that MPs have figured out to, you know, that they can exert pressure on the government. So I would expect to see more of that. I think it will certainly impact how the government shapes its policy. They will have taken note of that. I think now this goes back to the House of Lords. They will be working on new wording for an amendment. And so I don't think we've heard the last of this issue at all.
Meanwhile, of course, another big issue is coming back to bite the government, and it's got a B at the beginning. It's Brexit, inevitably. We're seeing rotting meat stuck in ports, rising wine prices. We're seeing empty shelves in some parts of Northern Ireland, for example, shortages of hair dyes. I mean, the government said, oh, yes, teething problems. But is that really accurate? A lot of these things seem almost systemic.
Yeah, of course, it's not just teething problems. So, you know, it's true that the changes are massive. There are IT systems that aren't working properly. The forms are, you know, are confusing. There are too many of them. There are not enough officials to provide health certificates. So all of those sorts of things might become easier in time, and we'd have to expect that they will be. But there are core costs here that are not going to change. I mean, this is the new post-Brexit landscape, and those are the customs duties, the rules of origin requirements, all sorts of other hurdles that have to be cleared before goods can be traded between Britain and the bloc. And those are the things the government is really not acknowledging. It's blaming teething problems, as you said. It's blaming COVID. This morning, the government announced $23 million in subsidies to try to keep the Scottish and English fishermen happier. But I think there's going to be a very long line of industries and businesses that are going to want help on this. And the government can now go two ways. It can use the mechanisms in the agreement to try to smooth some of these areas and have, you know, we might say a little bit less Brexit. So there's review mechanisms. There are some 30 sub-councils that can be used to sort of tweak these different areas and just make trade a little less, full of kind of friction. Or it can respond to this by sort of blaming the EU, blaming implementation problems, blaming blaming businesses for not being ready. And then I think we see a kind of ratcheting up of tensions over time. And, you know, this is a movie we've all seen many times in British politics. And I just wouldn't rule out that it could go that way again.
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting one you touched on it was the fishing lobby. I mean, this was a group that were very in favour of Brexit, and now they're up in arms. It's not about quotas, which was the huge discussion topic when the trade deal was being struck, but rather it is about this red tape. Are we set for some sort of a clash, or do you think they can be pacified by what the government is promising them?
Well, we'll see. I mean, the fishing stock has to get from point A to point B in 24 hours or it's no good. The value declines, it rots, you know, or they have to freeze it and sell it. So, it's kind of astonishing that this hadn't really become to the forefront earlier, because red tape means delays that ruins the ability of a lot of these long-time family-owned fishing concerns to move their catches from the processing plant to the customer. And you know, the government can try to smooth some of these things with subsidies, as it has, but those problems won't easily go away. And as you say, we are not even talking about what happens with quotas. That's going to come down the line in about 5 years' time as well.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.